The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, this is Richard Martin with a wake-up call on Monday, the 2nd of August at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Well, this is from a Financial Times article I sent out to my email distribution group yesterday, and I thought I should bring it to your attention. It is a very sobering account of what middle-class America has become. And I quote, "The slow economic strangulation of millions of middle-class Americans started long before the Great Recession, which merely exacerbated the personal recession that ordinary Americans had been suffering for years. Dubbed median wage stagnation by economists, the annual incomes of the bottom 90% of U.S. families have been essentially flat since 1973, having risen by only 10% in real terms over the past 37 years. That means most Americans have been treading water for more than a generation. Over the same period, the incomes of the top 1% have tripled. In 1973, chief executives were, on average, paid 26 times the median income. Now, the multiple is above 300. The trend has only been getting stronger. Most economists see the great stagnation as a structural problem, meaning it is immune to the business cycle. In the last expansion, which started in January 2002 and ended in December 2007, the median U.S. household income dropped by $2,000. The first ever instance where most Americans were worse off at the end of a cycle than at the start. Worse is that the long era of stagnating incomes has been accompanied by something profoundly un-American, declining income mobility. Alexis de Tocqueville, the great French chronicler of early America, was once misquoted as having said, "America is the best country in the world to be poor." That is no longer the case. Nowadays, in America, you have a smaller chance of swapping your lower income bracket for a higher one than in almost any other developed economy, even Britain on some measures. To invert the classic Horatio Alger stories, in today's America, if you are born in rags, you are likelier to stay in rags than in almost any corner of old Europe. Combine those two deep-seated trends with a third, steeply rising inequality, then you get the slow-burning crisis of American capitalism. It is one thing to suffer grinding income stagnation. It is another to realize that you have a diminishing likelihood of escaping it, particularly when the fortunate few living across the proverbial tracks seem more pampered each time you catch a glimpse. "Who killed the American dream?" say the banners at left-wing protest marches. "Take America back!" shout the right-wing Tea Party demonstrators. Statistics only capture one slice of the problem, but it is the renowned Harvard economist Larry Katz who offers the most compelling analogy. Quote, "Think of the American economy as a large apartment block. A century ago, even 30 years ago, it was the object of envy. But in the last generation, its character has changed. The penthouses at the top keep getting larger and larger. The apartments in the middle are feeling more and more squeezed, and the basement has flooded. To round it off, the elevator is no longer working. That broken elevator is what gets people down the most. End of quote. Unsurprisingly, a growing majority of Americans have been telling pollsters that they expect their children to be worse off than they are. During the three post-war decades, which many now look back on as the golden era of the American middle class, the rising tide really did lift most boats, as John F. Kennedy put it. Incomes grew in real terms by about 2% a year, almost doubling each generation. And although the golden years were driven by the rise of mass higher education, you didn't need to have graduated from high school to make ends meet. So much for the rising tide. From the point of view of most economists, the story so far is uncontroversial. Most agree on the diagnosis, but they diverge on the causes. Many on the left blame the great stagnation on globalization. The rise of China, India, Brazil, and others has undercut wages in the West and put America's unskilled, semi-skilled, and even skilled workers out of jobs. Manufacturing now accounts for only 12% of U.S. jobs. Think of the typical Detroit car worker 30 years ago who had a secure middle-class lifestyle, good health care, and a Fiat pension to look forward to. Today he lives in Shenzhen. Another group singles out the explosion of new technology, which has enabled the most routine and easily automated jobs to be replaced by computers. Think of the office assistant who once took dictation and brewed the coffee. She is now a BlackBerry who spends half her life in Starbucks. Or the back office person who, much like those shoemakers in the fairy tale, now stitches your accounts in Bangalore while you sleep. Fewer than a tenth of American private sector workers now belong to a union. People in Europe and Canada are subjected to the same forces of globalization and technology, but they belong to unions in larger numbers, and their health care is publicly funded. More than half of household bankruptcies in the U.S. are caused by a serious illness or accident. Many of the jobs of the future will be in interpersonal roles that cannot be easily replaced by computers or foreigners. Janitors, beauty technicians, home carers, and landscape gardeners, for whom college is often superfluous. Furthermore, a large chunk of Americans who have been hit by stagnation over the past decade are college graduates. Even they are not immune. But more education, at the very least, will improve one's chances. Paying for it is another matter. While incomes in America are stagnating, the cost of education is soaring. Since 1990, the proportion of Americans who are paying off more than $20,000 in student loans a decade after they graduated has almost doubled. Lawrence Summers, Obama's chief economic advisor, who has long worried about the growth of what he calls America's anxious middle, points out that of the major economies, the U.S. has the highest share of graduates in the workforce. But if you take the 25 to 34-year-old age group, America isn't even in the top 10. What then is the future of the American dream? Michael Spence, a Nobel Prize-winning economist whom the World Bank commissioned to lead a four-year study into the future of global growth, admits to a sense of foreboding. Like a growing number of economists, Spence says he sees the great stagnation as a profound crisis of identity for America. For years, the problem was cushioned and partially hidden by the availability of cheap debt. Middle-class Americans were actively encouraged to withdraw equity from their homes or leech from their retirement funds in the confidence that property prices and stock markets would permanently defy gravity, a view, among others, promoted by half the world's Nobel Economics Prize winners, Spence not included. That cushion is now gone. Easy money has turned into heavy debt. Baby boomers have postponed retirements. College graduates are moving back in with their parents. The barometer is economic, but the anger is human and increasingly political. I have this gnawing feeling about the future of America, says Spence. When people lose the sense of optimism, things tend to get more volatile. The future I most fear for America is Latin American, a grossly unequal society that is prone to wild swings from populism to orthodoxy, which makes sensible government increasingly hard to imagine. Look at the Tea Party. People think it came from nowhere. While I don't agree with their remedies, most Tea Party members are middle-class Americans who have been suffering silently for years. End of quote. Spence admits he is thinking aloud and going way beyond the data, and he concedes that America probably still retains its most vibrant strength in its still world-beating capacity for technological innovation. Most economists are not as bleak as Spence, but it is in the neighborhoods among ordinary Americans that his pessimism gets its loudest echo. Quote, to be pessimistic about the future is so new for Americans and so strikingly un-American, but most people grasp their own situations way better than any economist. A very unprepossessing account, I should say, ladies and gentlemen, but I'm sure many of you recognize yourselves in those words, and many of your friends to boot. All right, well, this is Richard Martin, and this is the wake-up call, and I shall quickly run through my information for those who have recently joined the show. The toll-free number to call, if you would like a question to be answered and discussion to be had, is courtesy of PRN, and it is 888-874-4888, and it may be used at any point in the proceedings. And I would be very happy for you if you should so feel inclined to call and give your views, opinions, and ask your questions. Once again, it is the toll-free number 888-874-4888. My email, which can be used by those of you who would prefer to write in your questions and comments, the email is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once again, the email address, rm@gfawd.com. And my a direct line number for those who would like to call in and basically ask a question about your personal finances or economic conundrum, then please feel free to call me at a Sarasota, Florida number, which is going to be directed automatically to Singapore, where I am. And the number is area code 941-441-1682. Again, the area code 941-441-1682. Okay. Well, the American economy is so awful that the Wall Street Journal reports, parents of means are now resorting to buying franchise businesses to keep their adult children employed, shelling out six-figure sums to purchase their little darlings, pizza pit restaurants, and college hunks hauling junk moving trucks, watching fellow college students working for $7.50 an hour after graduation Tina Walther, a fashion design major at Kent State University in Ohio, snapped up an alternative offered by her father to run a Peter Pitt restaurant he would buy. "I guess I bought her a job," says her father. Jan Walther of North Canton, Ohio, prospects of a career in fashion seemed remote, and Tina, a college athlete, loved eating at Peter Pitt restaurants while traveling with her track team. Her first new restaurant opened last year near campus in Kent, and the 25-year-old hopes to open several more. Before we all let out a collective yuck, let's take a look at what's driving the trend. First up, of course, is the economy. And according to the Pew Research Center, unemployment among those aged 18 to 29 is higher than it has been in decades, with job offers for new college graduates half of what they were in 2007. Applications to law and business schools are soaring as students, desperate to find a safe harbor during the recession, decide to use the time to burnish their credentials for when the economy improves. Even non-paying internships have become so competitive that enterprising charities are making a mint auctioning off gilded gigs at Vogue and other prestige firms. However, evidence is mounting that more and more parents are beginning to rebel at paying the ever-soaring tab for higher ed, with a study recently released by Countrywide Financial finding the number of mums and dads who say college is a good investment in their child's future earning potential has dropped dramatically since 2008. As the Wall Street Journal notes, many parents see business ownership as a better bet for their kids' future than a graduate degree. And in this era of renewed interest in entrepreneurship, some parents described it as a way of recapturing for their children a stake in the American dream, the opportunity to control their destiny and have a chance at gaining wealth. Moreover, a recent survey by Merrill Lynch of affluent Americans, those defined as those with investment assets of at least $250,000, found that one-third were currently supporting at least one adult-aged child, with 28% doing so to help maintain the child's standard of living, and another 21% saying their son or daughter was unemployed and needed the aid. If you are already giving your adult children funds from the First National Bank of Mum and Dad, it isn't a huge logical leap that to then decide it is better to give the money in the form of a business rather than in the form of no-strings-attached handout. Then there is the impact of books like The Millionaire Next Door, which posit that the quickest path to riches is not a load of highfalutin degrees, but a business of one's own. Of course, the book's authors, Thomas Stanley and William Danko, also argued that giving money to adult children is a fast way to the poorhouse for both parent and child. But that's not a message many current mom and dads are used to calling up to schools to complain about their children's grades and otherwise engaging in checkbook parenting are likely to heed. Well, you know, just as much of America's elite is willing to shut down every factory in the country, if it is possible to open cheaper factories in countries like China, so much of the American ruling class would prefer not to hire their fellow Americans, even for jobs done on American soil. If less expensive and more deferential foreign nationals with fewer legal rights can be imported. Small wonder that proposals for guest worker programs are so popular in the U.S. establishment. Foreign guest workers laboring on American soil, like H-1Bs and H-2Bs, those with non-immigrant visas allowing technical or non-agriculture seasonal workers to be employed in the U.S., are latter-day coolies who do not have the right to vote. If much of America's investor class no longer needs Americans, either as workers or consumers, elite Americans might still depend on ordinary Americans to protect them by serving in the military or police forces. Increasingly, however, America's professional army is being supplemented by contractors, that is, mercenaries. And the elite press periodically publishes proposals to sell citizenship to foreigners who serve as soldiers in an American foreign legion. It is probably only a matter of time before some earnest pundit proposes to replace American police officers with foreign guest worker mercenaries as well. If the American rich increasingly do not depend for their wealth on American workers and American consumers or for their safety on American soldiers or police officers, then it is hardly surprising that so many of them should be so hostile to paying taxes to support the infrastructure and the social programs that help the majority of the American people. The rich don't need the rest anymore. If most Americans are no longer needed by the American rich, then perhaps the United States should consider a policy adopted by the aristocracies and oligarchies of many countries with surplus populations in the past, the promotion of emigration. The rich might consent to a one-time tax to bribe middle-class and working-class Americans into departing the U.S. for other lands and bribing foreign countries to accept them in order to be alleviated from a high tax burden in the long run. Where would a few hundred million ex-Americans go? The answer is obvious: to the emerging markets where the work and investment are to be found. That will show all those American Union members who complain that their jobs have been outsourced to China. Let them move to China themselves and compete instead of complaining. Needless to say, the Chinese and Indians might resist the idea of an influx of vast numbers of downwardly mobile North American workers. But like American capitalists, Chinese and Indian capitalists might learn that ethnic diversity impedes unionization, while the mass immigration of North Americans to East and South Asia would keep wages in those regions competitively low for another few decades at least. Once emptied of superfluous citizens, the U.S. could become a kind of giant aspen for the small population of the super-rich and their non-voting immigrant retainers. Many environmentalists might approve of the depopulation of North America because sprawling suburbs would soon be reclaimed by the wilderness. And deficit hawks would be pleased as well. The middle-class masses dependent on Social Security and Medicare would have departed the country, leaving only the self-sufficient rich and foreign guest workers without any benefits other than the charity of their employers. Of course, there are alternative options which involve ordinary Americans taking back their country. But restoring democratic nationalism in the U.S. would inconvenience America's affluent minority. So instead of making trouble, maybe most Americans should just find a new continent to call home. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, how are we doing for time? We've got about 5 minutes. Let's take a couple of emails here. I got an email from Mario, who is an expatriate living in China. I did actually email him asking him to call into the show because I thought his opinion might be rather interesting to share with all of you, since he is living in China and he does have access to Skype. And I don't know how that's going to work. I thought maybe he could call me first and we could try it out. And if it worked, then he could call in the show. But he is the first person in China that I have had calling in, or rather listening into the show. So his opinion might be rather interesting. Anyway, he says as follows. The 30% chunk of the middle class in America whose lives and careers and futures have been decimated may as well pack their bags and come to the APAC China region to teach English at $20 an hour, because that's loads better than anything they're going to find staying put. Those are the folks in the wrong place at the wrong time in the annals of history's economic and political cycles. We should genuinely feel for their plight, including many whom I know personally. The struggling middle class on down will feel poorer and poorer over the coming years, a daily reality much easier to deal with if you live in China or Asia than if you live in America or Europe. Well, I would probably go along with that, actually, Mario, and I'd love to hear more of what you think. If you should feel inclined to call me at some point during the week, we can test out the situation, and then we can see if it might be worth a call into the show on Friday. Right, that's Mario. I got an email from Marek. And Marek says, hello, Richard. I would like to ask you, what do you think the dollar might do from now until the next 3 months or so? Thank you so much for all the great work you do. Best regards, Marek. Well, Marek, the dollar has fallen so fast, that I feel that it is extremely likely that we will be shortly looking at quite a strong rebound. So if you are inclined to sell dollars and buy foreign currencies, I would, which is what I guess you are looking at, which is why you are asking the question about the next 3 months, my advice is to hold off until we've seen quite a sharp rebound, about 10% in the rebound, and then I think you might consider buying your currency. But you do not say why you're interested in the 3 month time frame, so I can't really advise you further than that. But anyway, Marek, hope I've helped. All right, well, interestingly enough, one of a friend of my wife and I wrote in just a few hours ago. She lives in Brazil, and she wrote in an email as follows, and she says this, and I think the email is self-explanatory. She says, hi, dears. Remembered Richard this weekend. The daughter of a good friend of mine lives in a very nice home in Menlo Park, California, near Stanford. They suffered an armed assault today with a sister-in-law violently knocked to the ground at 8:30 a.m. as she was entering the garage door after going for a morning walk and kept on the ground with a gun against her head, and another man entered the kitchen, also with a gun, where there was a nanny with four small children. Fortunately, in the end, there were guests in the guest house, and my friend's daughter and husband upstairs, who woke up with the noise of the woman falling to the ground, saw from a distance what was happening and called 911. Details more complicated, but in the end, no victims. Did remember, however, Richard saying that the crisis would end up creating violence. Have to run. Have a great week. Beijos, which is the Portuguese for besos, which is the Spanish for kisses or greetings. Astrid. Well, thank you, Astrid, for that. If you're listening, I'm very grateful for any kind of on-the-ground news or confirmation of what's really going on out there from interested participants. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is going to get much worse. I am absolutely convinced of it. It is why I am advising you to leave. For what it's worth, I myself was mugged twice in the 90s in the New York area, at gunpoint both times. Karen, who used to be my assistant, had her niece held at gunpoint by a youth, a teenager, while getting into her car. And so the information is there. There are people who are able to witness the events such as I'm afraid they will unfold in the next 5 to 10 years. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, it's time for our break, so we shall have it, and I will be back in a few moments to continue the joy.
The Progressive Radio Network, your premier progressive radio station.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. And again, I would remind you of my number to call in if you would like to offer an opinion or offer up a question maybe or start a discussion. It is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. There's an interesting article by Bill Bonner. I do often quote him. He is a very eloquent commentator, probably the most eloquent of all American commentators today that I know. And he seems to be traveling predominantly between Europe and the United States right now. His group, Agora Publishing, just finished what I would consider to be the definitive seminar or series of seminars on the economy on an annual basis held in Vancouver every year. He had this to say a few days ago. He said, a few days ago was Bastille Day in France, their national day. When the revolution was over, the French had no king. So they welcomed an emperor, Napoleon I. Is that progress or what? The revolution, the terror, the directoire, the empire, the Napoleonic Wars. Was the typical Frenchman better off for all the drama and bloodshed? Wouldn't he have done better to fix his roof and plant cabbages? Most likely. He began with a monarchy, albeit imperfect. Finally, he had a republic, albeit imperfect. In between, he had various sorts of governments held together by duct tape and illusions. Did any of them plant a single seed or reap a single pound of grain? Did any of them earn a centime or a sou? Did any of them discover penicillin or the telegraph? Did any of them do a single thing that made a net positive improvement in the lives of the French? Probably not. The people cannot seem to resist politics. The hope of getting something for nothing is too great. Besides, there's the excitement of it, the thrill of engagement, the roar of the cannons and the smell of the crowd. There's the feeling of pride and excitement when the ballots are counted or the troops walk by. Understanding the Fed's reaction to the current crisis is impossible without realizing that people are forever setting out to do mischief to others and usually to themselves. Very pithy. Like that, I thought it was worthy of your attention, and I hope you enjoyed it, ladies and gentlemen. All right, well, an email just came through from Bill, who says, "Hello, Richard. I agree the economy is terrible. Everyone I know is beginning to understand that, yet the stock market soars. I have to assume it is manipulated. How long can this continue?" Well, that is a good question, Bill. It is a good question because if you look at the history of bear markets, you will always find that they are pockmarked by these very, very vicious rallies or bear market rallies, which tend to try to shake people out of their short positions and encourage more people to come in and buy. And it is just it is axiomatic that these rallies which come from nowhere and basically have absolutely no logic in the scheme of things, especially in the fundamentals, die as quickly as they come. And what you have to be aware of is that the kind of sentiment and the technical underpinnings of the market, which is so valid and valuable in bull markets, that's to say markets which are going up as a general trend, are quite useless in bear market rallies. And so what happens is that as the market goes up in the bear market rally, you find that the pundits and the analysts and the brokers and all of the people whose job it is to encourage people to buy stocks use the time-honored minutiae of analysis to support their case that the market is going higher and bring in the public and all the people who should be out of the market, and just at the point when the majority have invested in the market turns around and goes back down. And that is exactly what is happening this time. And indeed, it is what happened between 2003 and 2007. That was really a massive bear market rally, which was quite the longest that has ever been seen, I think, in the history of stock markets without any competition. And just at the time in 2007, where everybody thought the market was going much higher, the market turned around and collapsed, thereby bringing losses to the greatest number of people. And Bill, although I can't give you a day and a time when this thing is going to end, I assure you it will end, and it will end very soon, and it will end very badly. And the trick and the key in these things, in my way of seeing them, is not to try to label them and to put time frames on them. Because if you do that, you're bound to be disappointed, either because you're too early or because you're too late. The way to deal with this is to allow the market to tell you when it's going to turn down, and not to take positions which you know to be antithetical to the basic market trend, which this time, of course, is down. So what I would say to you is, whatever you're trying to do in the markets, make sure that they are synonymous with a basic bear market. That's to say, a market which is going to go down, and then either be ready to invest in short positions when the market shows it's going to go down, or liquidate long positions if you happen to have any on the way up, so that you're not caught, you know, with your pants down, as it were, when the market turns round. And so that's the best I can do. But surely this will not last. The economy is getting worse as we speak. The fundamentals are deteriorating quite dramatically, I would say, especially in the real estate market, both commercial and residential. People are losing their jobs with greater intensity, despite the fact that the government lies about the figures. And you know, I can go into that, but it's somewhat esoteric and really unnecessary, because the figures actually speak for themselves. But in just about any metric that you care to name, things are getting worse. Why are corporate profits getting better? Why have they improved? Very simply, because the people who have been laid off have reduced the costs per unit of production, meaning that now production takes place with fewer people and working longer hours, being paid less, and so the companies are able to report greater profits. But unfortunately for the companies, they won't be able to continue doing this, because in order to have profits, you have to have sales. And if you look at the sales of any of the last quarters, you will see that they have dropped precipitously, meaning that the profits are ephemeral and do not, as usual, tell the whole story. So you have to go back and look at the whole picture in order to see where you stand. And as I always say to you, ladies and gentlemen, avoid listening to the pundits, avoid the talkers on CNBC, and those who write in the Wall Street Journal, those who basically try to give you information. The chances are high that it will be bad information, and it will cause you to do things that you will come to regret. So there we are. Thank you, Will, for your question, and hopefully it has been of some use. Well, the Austrian school has seven commandments, and these are the Austrian free market economists who use common sense principles as opposed to pie-in-the-sky Pollyanna putrid nonsense. They say, they're all true, you cannot spend your way out of a recession. In other words, any amount of stimulus program is just a way to paper over the cracks. You cannot regulate the economy into oblivion and expect it to function. And again, I've always said that this concept of increased regulations just simply points up the inadequacy of the original regulators who simply were not doing their jobs with a perfectly adequate number of regulations with which to have prevented all of the shenanigans that have taken place over the past 10, 15 years. None of this need have happened. Greenspan in particular had plenty of ammunition with which to stop this. The fact that he's now running around trying to cause revisionism to obliterate the realities of life should not be of any consequence to you, ladies and gentlemen. The man is a charlatan, and he should be considered as such. You cannot tax people and businesses to the point of near slavery and expect them to keep producing. Well, that brings into question these tax cuts, or rather the end of the tax cuts at the end of the year, when taxes will be going up unless the tax cuts are held out by Congress. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you don't need me to tell you what increased taxes are going to do to your bottom line. You cannot create an abundance of money out of thin air without making all that paper worthless. Well, I've said time and again that every time you print money, all it does is makes the value of the money in existence that much less in direct proportion to the amount of money that's been printed. So it's quite pointless to print money because the money is already there. What people never seem to realize is that the money which is already in the system never went away. It could be spent again. The people who have the money could turn around and spend it if they wanted to. The truth is they don't want to because they know that there's trouble. And they know that if spending money will simply put them into more trouble and give them more debts to have to pay down, and they're busy enough paying down debts as it is. So why would any more money in terms of another stimulus package change the picture? If anybody can answer that question, let us know. Call in. Let's hear from you, because I don't know the answer to that one, and frankly, I don't think anybody else does either. The government cannot make up for rising unemployment by just hiring all the out-of-work people to be bureaucrats or send them unemployment checks forever. Well, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, the government has made a lot of issue out of hiring people to do the census work, but of course that's coming to an end right now, so that's going to add back into the unemployment figures. What are they going to do with all these people? I mean, they could, you know, hire them to mend all the roads, especially in many cases roads which are perfectly serviceable. Unemployment checks, I don't know about unemployment checks. You can't allow people to starve, of course. But giving them money seems to be to more ladling out more of the drug that was responsible for the problem in the first place. So I don't know that money is the answer. I think, there are other ways to look at this problem. But, political expediency in front of a midterm election is obviously paramount in the minds of those who make the decisions. So what can I say? You cannot live beyond your means indefinitely. Well, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who have lived beyond your means know exactly what I'm talking about, and those that haven't have read more than enough about people who have. So I don't really think there's any comment needed on that one. I mean, it calls into question those who took out loans that they shouldn't have taken out, those who bought houses they couldn't afford, those who bought cars they couldn't afford, went on vacations that they couldn't afford. I guess the best one can say is that the world has learned a lesson, and it will be many generations before people repeat that kind of idiocy. But repeat it, they will. Count on it. Long after all of us have gone to meet our heavenly makers, these people will be at it again. Just human nature never changes. The economy must actually produce something others are willing to buy. Well, sure. I mean, that's the whole essence of what wealth is all about. The creation of wealth is indeed the creation of things that people need. And frankly, I don't know how many people need any more gewgaws from China, or you know, new cars or new houses. I understand they're still building houses like there was no tomorrow in Las Vegas, which is the city worst affected by the housing crisis. I mean, how insane is that? I mean, I know all the old stories about real estate companies. Yes, they've got land that they have to build on because otherwise the land will be worthless and they'll get more money building the land and selling the land with something on it than if it had nothing on it. I know all those arguments, but it doesn't do much to support the position of builders and others who have property that's going down and down in price by adding to the supply. I'm afraid it's just merchandise that is not in demand. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, it's not in demand. And if you add to it, then you've only got yourself to blame when you go bankrupt because the value of everything you own goes down in price. So, I don't know. Well, you know, after listening to all that, you're undoubtedly tempted to say, I knew all of this. Well, if you did know it, ladies and gentlemen, the only thing I can say is that you're not a Keynesian economist. You have what is known as common sense. Well, you know, in case you didn't know it, all of those things that I mentioned, the corollary, are those things which are believed by what are called Keynesian economists or inflationists, people who believe that if you can possibly force prices higher, everybody will be more wealthy. That is the most idiotic concept, but it is a concept which was behind everything that the New Deal was all about and everything that Ben Bernanke is all about. So watch out, ladies and gentlemen, you've got some very, very stupid people running your government and they're not about to step down. Well, things aren't much better in Europe. And as you know, they just had their own version of the bank stress tests, which in the United States had, a little while back. And frankly, the European ones were even worse. They were a little more than a bad joke. And I was reading an article in the Financial Times by John Kay, who said, and I quote what he says, he says, the concept of stress tests is derived from the procedures used to ensure the robustness of complex engineering structures. There are three stages. You begin by testing each component in conditions considerably more demanding than it is likely to encounter. Then you review system design to ensure that even if several elements break down simultaneously, this does not jeopardize the integrity of the whole structure. Third, and most importantly, you test the total system for outcomes far outside the range of experience. You do not ask, will the bridge survive a strong gust of wind? You ask, will it survive a gale worse than any at this site in the last century? End of quote. And his conclusions of how the Europeans did as follows. There is much that the finance sector could learn from this, but no indication that it has done so. The adverse scenario of the bank stress tests, far from being outside the range of experience or expectation, is not far from the mean. Worse, the stress tests are self-referential. Their purpose is to show not that the bank is sound, but that it meets the requirements for regulatory capital. But one lesson of 2008 was that capital adequacy was almost irrelevant in a crisis. Shamefully, the purpose of the stress test is not to ensure that depositors' money is safe or that taxpayers will not be called on again. The purpose is to reassure banks and their shareholders that they will not be required to provide significant additional capital. The lesson, perhaps the only lesson of the stress tests, is that Europe's politicians and regulators have not begun to address, far less resolve, the issues posed by the crisis of 2008. End of quote. So you see, without going into the complicated details of how ridiculous these results were and how they were arrived at, the obvious conclusion from all this is that the European stress tests were designed for banks to pass, not fail. That alone ensures that the design and implementation of the tests was faulty from the first day. Ay, ay, ay. Well, I was looking through some information the other day, and I came across this blogger, which I thought was interesting. He was answering a post about the odious Greenspan on Zero Hedge, which I know many of you follow. And I quote, "I would think you must live in Afghanistan or Mongolia. If you lived in America, you could easily see for yourself that prices are much lower now that there is a little access to credit, which buoys prices. Look on Craigslist. Matter of fact, look under gold and silver coins. Lots of ads I've been seeing lately have been guys liquidating silver and gold to pay off debts. In fact, I had some to liquidate myself about a month ago, and it used to take less than a day to sell whatever I put up. It took days before I even got a call last time. People don't have cash for these items. They need Federal Reserve notes, otherwise known as money, to settle debts, and the vast majority of people are in debt up to their eyeballs. The phenomenon is that people will sell big-ticket items for whatever they can get in the hopes of at least keeping a roof over their heads. I have been going to tool auctions and buying up things for pennies on the dollar in many instances, and it's going to get much worse once the government lifelines are thrown to the wayside. I would think that people need cash to settle debts. If you have cash, then you're in a great position to supply that demand at fire sale prices. It was the hyperextension of credit as money which drove prices higher in the last 10 years, not the printing of mass paper currency or money. This is where you have become blind. The two are separate, and the printing of paper currency at this stage will do nothing, as it will be hoarded just like the rest of paper currency currently is. People who think they have dollars in the banks are going to be sorry to realize too late that those dollars are simply loans to the banks, not for their safekeeping. The FDIC could never cover more than a minute percentage of bank deposits." Ladies and gentlemen, in that quote is a lot of wisdom. And I've said this to you many times. Gold is simply a means to wealth. It is not wealth itself. And I am here to tell you that many people who have gold need that means to wealth to pay off their debts. I've said this from the start. And whereas I believe that gold will maintain its value vis-a-vis other things, and I've said this many times as well, you're going to find that as the economic and financial situation gets worse and worse, so people, more and more people are going to have to sell their gold in order to pay down their debts. And that's why you're going to see an avalanche of selling coming into the precious metals. It will happen, in my opinion. I may be the only human being on the face of the earth to say this, because I couldn't find, if my life depended on it, I couldn't find anybody else saying the same thing, except apparently this blogger, who should be held up to the light and, exalted. And by the way, this question of inflation, he's hit the nail absolutely on the head. It's credit that drives prices higher and has driven prices higher, not money. You know, ladies and gentlemen, how much credit has been extended. And when credit is extended willy-nilly, then of course prices go higher because people can afford to bid higher for things, and it becomes like a frenzy of people bidding other people's money. Remember, it's other people's money they're spending on these houses and these cars and these vacations. It's not their own money. How many people shell out cash to buy a house? They shell out credit. And that's why credit has caused prices to rise, and that's why prices are falling now, because credit is not being extended anymore. And people who have money are going to need that money to pay down those debts. So I have no idea where people who believe in inflation think that inflation is going to come from. Who has money to compete for assets today? Who has money to compete for gold? Who has money to compete for houses? House prices are falling, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't noticed. And they will continue to fall. And the more they fall, the more people will sell, and the more they'll be out of work, and the more they'll sell, and the more prices will fall. It is a snowball effect, and it is going to continue. Well, finally, I saw a recent article by a Michael Roseff, which I thought I would excerpt just a few lines from. I thought he had an interesting point of view. He said, and I quote, "The government of the United States markets itself as the nation's defender. It advertises that it provides security nationwide for we the people. It claims that it provides military security, economic security, and social security. These are all false claims. More and more Americans recognize these claims as false. More and more Americans recognize that the United States government has reduced their security in all its many forms. The United States government has succeeded in entangling Americans in an endless succession of foreign wars. It has succeeded in retarding and even reversing standards of living. It has succeeded in raising medical care costs and reducing the quality of medical care. It has perpetuated a Ponzi scheme of social security that is doomed to fail. The United States government is responsible for reducing American freedoms, for spying on Americans, for searching them, and for turning travel into a nightmare. More and more Americans realize that promises of security do not create security. More and more Americans realize that the United States government creates insecurity and disorder. The United States government does not deserve the tax dollars it collects. This is the fundamental bread and butter reason for ending the Union. The Constitution allows massive tax collections for purposes enunciated by Washington. There is no way to stop this process, which is killing the country, except by undoing the political foundation by which it is enforced." Well, ladies and gentlemen, with those words from Michael Roseff, I shall sign off and hope that we will be back again on Friday. I look forward to it. Have a wonderful week. Take care. Bye-bye.